based on Kili B'nai Yisrael Avadim, which may have a specific Jewish component to it, but may also indicate a certain theme. And if it's a theme, then especially when we get into Lefnei Meshuras Hadin, if this is a basic agenda kind of idea, so then that would apply at least on a theoretical level of what's right and wrong would apply across the board, even if technically it can be connected to a pasuk. It's interesting if you branch out, so let's say if we get into topics of ribbis and ona, so ribbis I think is unique in this way. In general, the concept of din, we talk about justice and principles of justice, so that's one of the shavim mitzvahs b'ninoach. So it should theoretically apply across the board. The Ramban had a chiddush. The Ramban in his commentary to Vayishlach, so he has a chiddush that he thinks all the dinim of Choshe Mishpat specifically are included in din, and that the whole world is obligated to follow Choshe Mishpat basically, which is a big chiddush. I remember once heard Rav Shlomo Fisher to say that if you think that's because that everything in Choshe Mishpat is logical and you can figure it out, says there are more Xerashavas and Kalvachomers in Bav Mesia than there are in Paraduma. If you think it's just so easy to figure out everything in there, that's why it should apply. So it's a big chiddush. There are Ramah has a tshuva about that to discuss whether that's really what it means, or there's another way to read it, but that's what it sounds like from the Ramban, that it applies essentially across the board. Now, Ribbis is a clear exception to that. Ribbis is clear from the Torah itself that does not apply between Jews and non-Jews, and it's interesting to keep it consistent with the Ramban that that's actually not even in Choshe Mishpat, which is the whole discussion itself. By Ribbis is in a different section of Shulchan Aruch, so if we talk about that, which I'm happy to talk about, it's a whole, it may probably take a few weeks, but that it's interesting to pursue and to discuss why that is a uniquely Jewish component. And that's really different from a lot of other things that we talk about. Onah, which just very briefly translated would mean, let's say, price fraud, which means if you're going to take advantage of the ignorance of the other party in terms of what the price of something should be, and in either direction, if you're the buyer or the seller, if you're going to overcharge as the seller or underpay as the buyer because the other party is not really aware of what the price should be, so then that's a prohibition of the Torah. The Gemara says in one place that it sounds like that applies only to Jews, but all the Achronim explained, Mr. Mesiakov is a tshuva, that, and this is consistent with a different comment of the Ramban, that this doesn't mean that it's permitted to violate the prohibition of Anah in that context. It means that there are certain specific details about Anah, about when the deal gets reversed and when it gets upheld but the extra gets reversed, etc., etc. So as a penalty, there's two halves of Anah. There's a prohibition and there's a penalty. So the penalty has certain specific details, but the prohibition applies across the board. It doesn't make a difference whether you're dealing with Jews or non-Jews. The prohibition across the board, no matter who you're dealing with. So basically, we have a whole amalgamation of halachas here. It depends on what we're talking about. Ribbis is very much a notable exception. We have to discuss why that is. But for the most part, it seems that for one reason or another, most of the details are going to apply, no matter who you're dealing with, whether as absolute letter of the law or whether as spirit of the law that we are basically seeing as the underlying theme. So I don't know if that addresses your question specifically, but have to see as we get along whether that's enough to kind of give a framework for some of the questions. Okay, so just a very quick poll. So do you have a sense, should we focus exclusively in going through the parak and going through employers and employees? Should we get Ribbis in the discussion? Should we get on the discussion? Should we get any other business topic in the discussion? Quick sense? Okay, so you can think about this. Sorry?
Yes.
Yes, okay, yes, all right. So anyway, either way for today, I'd like to...
Maybe.
Right, maybe. So maybe you let Mr. Olinsky know if you want to, for example, here, this is a fascinating area, but it would take us into that for so if there's a specific sense. So no, it's at least a day, you know, more than a day. So it's so many weeks in the summer. So you'll decide what you think is most interesting. But just for today, so to focus, last week we spoke in generalities about Lefnim Rishon HaSadin, so to speak a little bit about some more specifics about Lefnim Rishon HaSadin and what it means. It's a mysterious concept. So it's interesting, the sixth parak again, sixth and seventh prakim above Messiah talk about workers and their employers, but there is, with all the details you find in these two prakim, so if you put together the end of the sixth parak and the beginning of the seventh parak, you find two important principles that kind of override a lot of the details or underscore a lot of details depending on how you want to look at it. Because the beginning of the seventh parak, and this is a topic we'll come back to, the Mishnah beginning of the seventh parak talks about some of the basic assumptions of what the workers are provided with, etc., etc. But then includes this very crucial line at the end of the Mishnah, Hakol Kiminig Amedina. So you find that whatever the local practice is has a lot of impact on what the understandings are. So even though the halacha has certain expectations, but those expectations, it turns out, in a little bit of a surprising way, you have to figure out, this is not what we're going to focus on today, but sometimes take a back seat for whatever the local practice is. Local practice is different, then that is understood to be the working assumption, and then that redefines what the rules are. And the other perspective, the end of the sixth paragraph, the very, very end, so the Gemara seems to be addressing without identifying it so clearly, and we mentioned this Gemara last week outside, but now to look at it inside, that the Gemara talks about Lefnim Mishur Sadin as a important principle in terms of how employers relate to their employees. That's what it sounds like. Just look at the Gemara inside. Again, we did mention it outside last week. The very last lines of the sixth parak on page Yimel Amad Aleph. So the Gemara talks about the situation of workers who break the stuff of the employer. They are handling his property, and in that context, they break it. So what exactly the chiyuv is? And it's a complicated area, because in general, you might think that there should be a reason to be more makel by the workers, that they're asked to be dealing with the stuff, that's their job, and there's a certain amount that's expected within the context of a day that may happen. So you might think we'll be a little bit more makel in terms of a worker than, let's say, a normal mazik, a normal other mazik, somebody who damages something. On the other hand, there's another reason for the chiyuvim to be a little bit more. We know that from the third part of the seal, working backwards, that in terms of hilchos omrim, if you have somebody who is in possession of somebody else's property, so they bear a certain amount of liability, and the liability are the four types of shomrim, so it basically correlates a little bit to if they're benefiting at all. So for example, if I pay you to watch something, so then the level of liability makes you a shomer sofer, the level of liability goes up, as opposed to if you're a shomer chino. If you are watching it for free, so then you have a lower level of liability. If you're a shoel, you borrow it, so you're benefiting from it, so then your liability is more than if you're watching it for my sake without benefiting from it all. So the idea, as the Rishonim was emphasized in those discussions, the hanah shoel, if you get the benefit, you have a higher level of obligation, so a worker is getting paid. So that itself may create a higher level of chiyuv when he's dealing with somebody else's property. So whatever the abstract din is, so the Gemara has this story at the very end of the parak.
Is benefit a physical or some type of personal benefit, or is it also kavod? Meaning that Adam Kosher would give someone something. Let's say Michael Jordan, signed basketball or something. So does covet of the person deem it more valuable than this, let's say, regular?
That it goes to the definition of how valuable it is, but already it would be for the benefit of the borrower, because for whatever reason he's borrowing it, he's any situation in which he's bearing any benefit from it would probably be because he's borrowing it. The definition of the other chassid's ownership of it is will just go to the character of why it's valuable, per se, but if the person borrowed it for that reason, so it's not going to fundamentally be different than a borrower need to play basketball.
Someone asks you to watch it, Rosh Chaim tells you, watch my safer, so everybody's going to say, oh, he has Rosh Chaim the safer.
So that itself is a covet.
Right, so he's doing it for the person who's asking him, but it brings covet upon him that, you know, someone of great stature is giving him something to watch for them.
You do find that factor playing a role in a lot of other areas of life. It's interesting whether or not that would impact the, whether that would switch liability here. It's an interesting question. You do find that when, for example, in Hilchos Kiddushin, you find that, right?
That was one of my thoughts.
Right, so you do find that in some areas of halacha, so it could be. But so here in the story, the last few lines and of the parak, in Pagim Amud Aleph, the Gemara says, Rabba Bar Bar Hanan. And if you look on the side of the page, so it quotes that different girsas, Rabba Bar Chana, Rabba Bar Huna, whoever it was, Rabba Bar someone, Tavrulei Hanau Shekulai Chavisa de Chamra. So his workers, they broke his barrels of wine. His workers, now, were they careless or not? So that's a little bit of a discussion. How exactly did they come to break it? So Rashi here mentions Chia. Possibly, is what it sounds like. It sounds like they were negligent, and they should be chayiv. So, what happened? So he shakol gumayu. So he held on to their garments. In other words, he was collecting this in payment for the damages that they did. So also Amr l'Rav. So they came and they complained to Rav that they wanted their stuff back. So Amr l'Rav, he said to them, he said to him, he said to Rabbi Barhana, so havlahu l'gumayu, give them back their clothes. They should get back their stuff that you're holding on to in payment for your broken barrels. Amalei dinahachi. So he said, that's the day. They break my things. I should give them back the payment for it. I shouldn't collect payment for what they broke. So Amalei, he responds, yeah, that's the day. How do you know? Because the Pasuk says, the Montelech b'derech tovman. Because the Pasuk says you should walk in the path of good people. That's a Pasuk in Mishlei. And that's what it would apparently would mean to do, is that you would not be so exacting and you would not hold on to their property in this case. So, okay, fine. So, Yoav Lahu Glimayu. So, he gave them back their clothes. So, Amr Lei, they said to him, Aniyei Anan, we're poor people. V'tarchinan kulioma. And we worked all day. In other words, not only do we want our clothes back, but we also want you to pay us for the day of work in which we ended up breaking your stuff. So, what was the response there? So the response, once again, part of their complaint is like a fin of less than me day. We don't have anything to eat. So Amalei, once again, Rav said, Zil have a grayu, pay them. So once again, his response is Amalei dinahachi. That's the halacha. I got to pay them if that's the kind of work they do. So Amalei, and he says, yeah, we are close to Sadiqim Tishmor. You want the second half of the pasuk, same pasuk in Mishlei. If you want to follow the path of Sadiqim, that's what you're going to do. You're going to pay the workers.
That's a different thing than Laman Telech B'derech Tovah.
Right, the same pasuk, two halves of the same pasuk, but it sounds like it's an escalation. So Tosus, not here, Tosus in the second parak is going to deal with what the implications of the two halves are. And it's interesting that neither of these are the other two Makoros that we're familiar with in terms of the basic Chiyav of the Simshur Sadin. So the Simshur Sadin, as the Chiyav comes up in a few places, or as a concept first, comes up in a few places, a lot of them are above Metziah, so it's just the easiest, the simplest path through Mar Makomos. So one is what we mentioned last week, the Ramban, that we focused on most of the time last week, was that the Ramban's interpretation, this week's Parsha, so it also works out well for that type of synergy, that Chiyuv of the Asisa HaYashar V'HaTov, that the Torah tells us that we have to do that which is straight and that which is good. And as we mentioned last week, the Ramban has a comment over there that this means that we have to figure out what the pattern is beyond the details, and that includes going with Nimashur Sadin. That includes, he mentions in that context, that we have to sometimes go beyond the letter of the law. Apparently that is a derivation from Vesisa Yashra V'Hatov. It's interesting, just while we're still coming off for Tisha B'Av, still from an Anathema perspective, and it's Parshas V'Eschanan, just a quick Dvar Torah along those lines. So I noticed an interesting idea in the Sefer Chavetzel HaSasharon, where he...
Sefer?
Chavetzel HaSasharon. So which, nice Sefer in the Parsha, it's about that they just came out with the last volume, and the end of the volume, so seven volumes now, each one's about 1,000 pages. So fix the shelf. So, but the first part of the Varnas has been out for a while, which came out at the end. But the first part of the Varnas that we have on in last week's Parsha, but it's commenting on this Pasuk. So because of the Pasuk in this week's Parsha, the Gemara says in Avodah Zarah that the Pasuk in Yehoshua identifies a Sefer HaYashar. The Sefer is called Sefer HaYashar. So what Sefer is that? So one possibility the Gemara says is Bereishis, because it's about the Avos, who are called Yisharim. And the other possibility is the Sefer Devarim, in which it says VaYashar VaHayashar VaHatov. So the Marsha asks that you find the word elsewhere in the Torah also, Sefer Shmos to find the word. So why should the Devarim be held up? So he connects there that if you look at the whole Pasuk, the Pasuk says Yasisa Yashar VaTov Beinei Hashem Laman Basa Virashta Sarat, along those lines, and that connects it to the inheritance of the land of Eretz Yisrael. So the Ramban, in his introduction to Dvarim, the Ramban talks about the fact that we have this idea that Dvarim is supposed to be a Chazara, is a Mishnah Torah, and yet we find a lot of mitzvot in Dvarim, a whole lot of mitzvot in Dvarim, which we wouldn't have known before Dvarim, don't get conveyed outside of Sefer Dvarim. So he has a theme there that Dvarim is specifically addressed Lenofle Haaretz, to those who are going to actually come in and settle Eretz Yisrael, and that the mitzvot that were particularly relevant to the Knesset and to Eretz Yisrael are the ones that are emphasized in Dvarim, and maybe even we hear about them from the first time because of their relevance there. So in that context, the idea of Dvarim being called the Sefer HaYashar and the connection into settling the land, so he seems to be suggesting, it's a short comment there, that as important as Yashrus and Tovness is in general, specifically if you're going to have a Kiyum in Eretz Yisrael, if we're going to have a Geula, if we're not going to be thrown out, if we don't want to have a Churban, we don't want to be in exile, so it's crucial, as we know, the whole emphasis in Sinas Chinam, Rabban L'Chaveru, that we find in the context of the Churban, so perhaps that's what the Pasuk is telling us, that if we want to have a Kiyum in Eretz Yisrael, so we have to have a specific Hakbada, these halachas on this type of Yashrus, which is the theme of Dvarim as a whole, but specifically also because it's connected to our ability to maintain a presence in a non-exile state. So in any event, so Yashar HaTov is one of the major makoros, which is invoked in the context of the Simishar Sadin. There's another makor also, which is not in this Gemara, is in the second parak. Second parak is an area in which
to the proof of Rav on mm-hmm. those 2 points that he's asked.
Mm-hmm.
Are those the Rises or Derech Noah? I mean, quoting Mishlei, is that like lower? I mean, at the end of the day, this is still Chiyu, but by quoting Mishlei, is he saying this is, you know, Derech Noah, this is the way a person should behave? Or is Rav calling this is a Issa the Rise, this is something that's against you? And I'm not sure whether how do we supposed to
do that? Why don't we just say Lotigno? Like, if this is Dina, then why is he quoting these?
Right, so it becomes. Exactly, so that's a fascinating question. We have to get to, we'll see some of these extra sources. But the whole Gemara poses a lot of questions. So the chance of the questions all taken is Dinder Eisa, Dinder Abanan. So first of all, so that we have to ask, the question that we're saying now is that why is the Tzukim and Chumash, one of which we just mentioned, the Yashar HaTov, the other we're about to mention, are both the Chumash itself, so why are those not the Tzukim invoked? And is there a difference between which Pesukim are invoked and which aren't? So that's not a question with an obvious answer. We'll see in a minute, hopefully, that there's a... Well, I may have to continue this a little bit also. We'll see that there's a Tosus that raises that question. And in terms of which Pesukim are used where. So we definitely have Pesukim and Chumash straight out. Why the Gemara cited a different Pesukim is an interesting question. We'll try to hopefully get to either in a second or beginning of next week. But
so Rav's second answer to them that he has to pay them, is that only because they requested it?
Presumably not because they requested it, but what might be relevant is that they identified themselves as Aniyim. That is a factor that is very important in the postgame. The question is...
But then you're over the other issue that you shouldn't judge people according to their... That aren't you over a greater Issa by doing a favor?
Yeah, maybe you have a bigger obligation to someone who's in money. It's not that you're judging them differently. They're entitled to something.
Now, these are all important questions. These are all very, very, very present questions. Because, first of all, we know the Torah says that a dying is not supposed to prefer a ani over an asher in general. So you have to figure out what that is. There is, it's clear from that Gemara and from this Gemara and from the Poskim, that the factor of an Ani versus an Asher plays into a Snimbus Harasadin. So that's something we have to try to understand a little bit. But the question that's kind of being circled around here is, if it's the Snimbus Harasadin, so how can we call it Din? Where's the line then? First of all, why does the Snimbus Harasadin exist? The question we already raised a little bit last week, that if it's desirable, if whatever the Snimbus Harasadin involves is something that's good, so then let's just peg the din over there. Then why do we peg the din at a lower place? Let's peg it at the better place. And especially, if you want to have two systems, it's hard enough to understand why that is, but it's even harder to understand if we're all of a sudden going to call the other one obligatory. So then, where is the difference between din and which din Mishra said din? And that's something that we're going to have to figure out. So it doesn't look like we'll get it all finished before Shacharis today, but just to introduce into the equation at least this other marker here from the second parak of Vav Metzia, which is just important to get into the conversation. So this is on Daf Lamed Amud Beis, and then we'll probably have to, there's a Tosfos much earlier the part that we'll probably have to get to next week that tries to reconcile all these points. But the second parak of Vav Metzia is a very important area for understanding the difference between din and lasam and mishur zedin, because the second parak, working backwards, we talk now about the second, fifth, fourth, third, second parak of Vav Metzia. So the second parak is about Hashavas Aveda, and Hashavas Aveda, we know we have this important mitzvah in the Torah to return lost property, but you could be very shocked by some of the dinim that you see in the second parak, because the loopholes, so to speak, the pturim within Hashavas Aveda really seem to be very surprising. There are all kinds of scenarios where you're actually allowed to keep property that you find, and you're not obligated. The most famous example, it's not the one the Gemara is picking up on here, but the most famous example is the whole area of Yeish, that if the person has given up hope on returning his property, so in many scenarios, speaking generally, it tends to remove the obligation to return the property to him. So that's hard to believe, that you should be allowed to keep somebody else's stuff just because he's given up hope on getting it back. And you find that when you read the Gemaras, and especially when you read the Poskim, the Rishonim and the Nosa Kelim and the Shulchan Aruch, then in practice it very often is not true, and very often we find that there is an obligation to go lifnei mishur hasadin in Hashavas Aveda. That there are cases where the Gemara tells you the letter of the law is you don't have to give it back, but in practice you're almost not tolerated as a decent person if that's the position you're going to take. Hi.
Doesn't the Yerushalmi come in a case when the property isn't identifiable?
Not necessarily. It's connected. It sounds like there are times when that's the driving force, but it's not the only... you theoretically could have a case, absolutely speaking in very generalities, you theoretically could have a case where somebody comes to you and says it's his, and you know that he's right, you know that it's his, and you're still theoretically exempt from giving it back to him, letter of the law, and yet you find that spirit of law, so to speak, with Nim Shara Sadin, is not that way, and there's little to no room in the posting to allow you to do anything other than with Nim Shara Sadin. So what exactly is that whole structure about? So okay, just to look very quickly at this Gemara in the end of, not the end of the Lamed Amud Beis. So the Gemara talks about, just to get in the middle of the passage here just so we can get some of the key points quickly. So the Gemara talks about Zakir Veinu Lefi Chvodo. And the idea that somebody who is a certain position of dignity, somebody who is an elder who has a very dignified position, and sometimes returning lost property is going to involve going through a process that's somewhat demeaning. So if that's the case, then the person is theoretically positive. So in dealing with one such case, the Gemara is right in the middle of the daf. The first words in the line are Hava Rabbi Shmuel. So there, in the, very much came in the middle of the sentence, but just to get into this point, so the Gemara says, Lefnim Mishur HaSadin Hu David. So this person, in this case, in the Gemara, acted Lefnim Mishur HaSadin. And where does that come from? Ditani Rav Yosef, the Hodata Lahem. So that's a reference to Yisro. Yisro in Parshas, same. In Parshas Yisro, the reason he gets the Parshas named after him, right, he tells Moshe that he should set up the hierarchical Bezin system, that he shouldn't deal with every specific case by himself, he should have the whole structure, and he should teach the Jews the main principles of life. He should teach the basic themes. And then he says to them, so what are all those words? The Gemara assumes all those words are significant. Rashi has in different places what that means, different things. The Gemara appears in Bavakam also, Rashi says differently in both places. Each one of these words we could speak about for an hour, but it'll take us off topic. But we're interested in the last part of the Pasuk. Right, so when the pasuk says you teach them what to do, that refers to din. Asher yasun zulufnim mishur sadin, and that refers to going above and beyond the law. So then the Gemara, the next few lines right before the Mishnah, the Gemara repeats some of those points, and then the Gemara ends off right before the Mishnah by saying, Asher yasun zulufnim mishur sadin. This speaks all of the year. Damar v'yochra b'char v'yishalayim ela al shadon ruba din Torah. And so that's this idea that the Jews were too machbid on the letter of the law. That's what led to the Churban, as we mentioned. That was what we emphasized last week in the pre-Chazon discussion. So here the Gemara quotes this pasuk in Parshas Yisrael as a chiyuv that there is this distinction drawn between a maisa asher yasun. So that's another major marker. So we'll have to discuss next week what Tosfos says about which one marker is used, another marker is used, and how this plays out practically. Just mention a little bit in terms of the drasha that's involved here, which is interesting. So how do you see this in the drasha? How do you see Samaisa Asher Yasun as referring to din and Lufnim Asher Yasadin? So that's what I used to think about this drasha more abstractly. So what I assumed it meant is that it's drawing a difference between theory and practice. That the Maisa is theory, that's the theoretical letter of the law, and the Maisa is how it's practical, but it's a theoretical practice. Asher Yasun, that which actually gets done, you know, the action, so right, the actual implementation will involve the Mishra. So that's why I always assumed the nature of the drasha was. I just started looking around a little bit more. I saw that the Meforshim, especially those who are particularly attentive to the relationship between Torah Shabbat and Torah Shabbat Sab, they see all kinds of interesting things in a slightly contradictory directions. The Netziv, in his commentary to Chumash, so he says that the adding of a nun at the end, Asher Yasun, that's a kind of a minimization, and it's basically saying that it's what's sometimes done. So sometimes you have to go above and beyond. So that's the same Asher Sadin. So Asher Yasun means the Maisa is what's generally done, and Asher Yasun is what's sometimes done, and that's when it's indicated to go Lufnim Asher Sadin. The Tar Tamima, who again is particularly attentive to how drushes are derived, so he says it kind of a different way, that an extra letter means to do extra. You go a little bit beyond, so an extra nun means it goes beyond the letter of the law. And the Haksav HaKabbalah has a very interesting point, which we'll end on for today, where he says along different lines that a nun means that it changes the word from an action to a person who is all about that. So Maisa is the action in the abstract, and Asher Yasun is the person who has the din inside of him, who becomes the character of din. So he goes on to basically explain that you cannot become a character of din just by following the letter of the law, because there'll be all kinds of scenarios in which the letter of the law will not connect to the essence of the law if you're just going to stick by the letter of the law. So if you want to be a person who truly understands din, if you want din not just to be what you do, but who you are, you want it to change from Yasun, from Maisa to Yasun, to you being a character of din, so you will have to go with Nim Nishur Sadin, because you will have to intuit the values of the system deeply enough that you'll realize when it is that you have to actually act beyond that, and therefore that's what the nun refers to. So it's a very interesting interpretation. There's basically three mahalchim that you'll find in the Rishonim in terms of how this nun connects to the Mishor Sadin, and it's really a different direction, that it's minimization. The others taking it in a different direction, but really three different ways of understanding the connection between Maisa and Yasun that the Pasuk is identifying. Hi.
Where's the requirement on the other side? Why is it only unilateral that
yes,
you're chayiv, I'm punter, and...
A great question. So that's kind of an important point to me. I think that it's very important to point out, we'll have to continue this next week, but from the practicalities of it, that I think it's a misconception. People think that l'snim mishur sadin is always the opposite of whatever the din is. Now that if the halacha says that Reuven, you have Reuven and Shimon, the halacha says Reuven wins, l'snim mishur sadin and Shimon wins. So I don't think it's true at all. I think that many cases, in most cases perhaps, if the halacha says Reuven wins, so Reuven wins. But there'll be scenarios where, for some reason, the l'snim mishur sadin favors Shimon, and that's what's going to. So we have to figure out. We have to try to lay down some principles as to why that is. So we'll look at that, God willing, a little bit.
The part of the right.
So exactly right. So why
their feet?
Right. So why should it be that? Why should it be that there's a scenario that we should flip it? If the law favors one side, so why should he not be allowed to be the winner in the end? So I think it's important to just, we'll have to pick it up next week, important to emphasize that it's certainly not as a matter of course that it always flips. There has to be some factor on the other side that makes it go that direction. I think